saying how much they want a strong woman. What they really want is a cheerleader.
I'd like someone who's physically very frail and won't stop talking.
I just want what everybody wants. I just seem to have a harder time getting it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Maximum Film. It's episode 324. And if you like Captain Marvel, guess what? There's more! It's your host, Ify Wadiwe, and in the booth with me are my friends. So let me introduce you to them. First up is a zaddy that needs no introduction, but I will do it anyway. It is none other than my favorite critic, amazing, esteemed programmer, critic, all of the above, and Christmas zaddy wearing a Santa shirt right now. Alonzo Duralde, what's good?
Oh, I'll tell you, Ify, I haven't nerded out in my what's good in a while, so I'm just going to say my what's good is that the special edition director's cut of The Abyss is getting a one-night-only theatrical reissue on December 6th. Does the finale still look like a giant bathtub toy? Sure, but along the way, there's so many other cool things that James Cameron enhanced and added and fixed that didn't get to be in the original theatrical cut of the movie. In a lot of ways, The Abyss is still my favorite of his films. Definitely a movie that you really want to see in a theater with like a kick-ass sound system, like the sonar pings go from like the front right to the back left. It's very cool. So if you've never seen The Abyss, if it's the one that you thought you could skip, maybe check this out. You've got if you can see it on the big screen, you know, with like, you know, all the yummy Dolby candy your ears can handle. Do recommend. And you know, Ed Harris and Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio make a sizzling on-screen couple.
I'm so excited for that because I remember loving The Abyss, but I have not seen it since it's come. I do not remember a single thing except for there's a shot where, or a couple where they're like in those like old school submarine helmet things and it fills like with the liquid and they have to breathe the liquid. That's all I remember. So I'm excited.
Oh, you remember the water column, right?
No.
Okay. Well, that was, look, for 1989, that was cutting edge CG effects work, and I'm sure it still looks great.
Yeah. Listen, I know I'm going to be delighted, and so the idea of getting to see on the big screen again with my new, you know, my just auteur eyes, my expert eyes, can't wait.
Jimmy C.
Yeah. Same here. You know, even though, you know, I do have the 72-inch, you know, experience at home, I always like to see a trip to the cinema. I like to enjoy that. I like to envision it. So
that's Ify's name on the apps is the 72-inch experience.
Oh, yeah. No. Let's shut it down.
Don't you know? And speaking of don't you know, we have none other than the queen of the Midwest herself, Super Festival programmer, producer, Drea Clark. What is good?
It's pronounced don't you know. What is good with me is, you know, I'm just going to toot my own horn. I'm very excited. I'm shifting my role a bit at the Bentonville Film Festival, and I'm now the artistic director.
Ew.
Man, do I love directing art or what?
Lady.
I'm very psyched. I've been with the festival for 9 years. I have tremendous respect for Gina Davis and all she does. And this is going to be our 10th anniversary this year. The festival's in June, and so getting started now to try and shape what all that will look like, how to celebrate the inclusion that our films and discussions and everything represents. So psyched, psyched, psyched.
Do you have Gina Davis's cell number?
Yes. Oh. Do I have mandatory weekly meetings with Gina Davis? Yes.
Nice.
Am I still her fan? Sure am.
Power flex.
Tamper it all down. Professional hat.
Will she teach you how to archer?
God, it's, you know, listen, if my pioneer counselor when I was 8 years old, I can't say Croy, couldn't do it, I don't know why Gina Davis would be able to help my geriatric ass now.
Always worth the shot. Yeah. Ify, what's good?
What's good with me is, you know, feeling good. I went and had some of that good old powder up in Mammoth, California, Mammoth Lakes, California. I am not talking about cocaine.
You
I'm
did that on purpose.
Snowboarding down the Sierra Mountains with very overcrowded, because there was only two lanes open because there was only about 1 to 2 inches of snow and the rest was snow made. But Mammoth has opened their season up and cramped all of us on those tiny trails. And now if he leans into his Californian roots to become a snow bum who is hanging out there. And it is funny because you forget that, you know, any extreme sport is just a hodgepodge of so many genres. You have like the dirty punk kids with all their, you know, stickers, and you have like, you know, the X Games. And then you got, of course, a giant Trump 2024 truck. And he was like, oh, yeah, we're all here together.
Here on this mountain, on the freshy fresh.
Yeah.
Please know the energy I was getting from your photos that you were posting was just entirely like, oh, this is Hot Tub Time Machine, but the modern day scenes. That's fully what I was getting, and what I also hope from all of your Mammoth experiences is gentle time travel.
One thing I didn't get on camera, which I wish I did, was that person in the Mammoth like mascot suit was in fact skiing down the mountain in the Mammoth suit. It is a surreal experience coming down here like, oh, this is...
What do you think they hired him to do?
Yeah, come on. What's he gonna? He's the Mammoth.
That's part of the job interview. Put this thing on, ski down the hill. You don't die. The job is yours.
Yeah, it's yours. Yeah, but clean out the blood before you put it on. Many have failed this part. All right, well, today we're learning about quantum entanglement with the Marvels, and then we'll take a hotline question about characters who don't make it to the end credits. But first, it's time for Itadic, our movie news segment where we ask the question, is this important and do we care? And to kick things off, Alonzo, why don't you bring in the good news?
Heyo, thank you, the nanny. Last Thursday, after a few weeks of back and forth deal making and 118 days on strike, SAG-AFTRA and the AMPTP finally came to an agreement on a new 3-year contract. That agreement has since been ratified with 86% of board members in favor of the deal. Thus ends, we hope, a truly wild chapter in Hollywood history, which we've been very proud to cover throughout Hot Labor Summer and beyond. Is this important? Do you care? And is this too good to be true?
Yeah, so, you know, it is important and we definitely care. I think all of us here, are a part of the industry as well as people who talk about it in your ears every Friday. As the end of the longest actor strike in history comes before us, the board has ratified it. Now we will all get the chance to vote on it as members of SAG-AFTRA. And there has been just a little bit of concern over just the one thing that kind of we're concerned about, which is the AI protections. I'm going to try and pull up the tweet. Who tweeted it again?
Justine Bateman.
Thank you.
Justine Bateman, interestingly, was the AI consultant for SAG during these and has a background in computer science. And so for anyone who's like, wait, she's not just Alex P. Keaton's girlfriend and Jason Bateman's sister. No, she also directed a film called Violet, High Five to Justine Bateman.
Yes. So just to paraphrase and read through her tweets at Justine Bateman on Twitter, she said, SAG actors, I want to make you aware of some language in the AI portion of the tentative SAG agreement. Though SAG leadership made such an effort to protect members in AI, there are many issues you should look at. I've saved the most serious issues for the end. And like any Twitter reader, I'm going to skip to the end.
By the way, but if he says we regarding SAG-AFTRA voters, he means himself, because neither Drea nor I are members of the union.
Yeah, sorry, I'm using the royal, the playing
he
royal
got a
on
mouse
TV
in his pocket.
We.
Yes.
But yeah, so it seems like there's language about digital doubles, which is if a digital double is made of you during the film, they must get your consent and inform you of their intentions for its use, except when the photography or soundtrack remains substantially as scripted, performed, and or recorded. This is going to be left up to the studio streamer's interpretation, and so any subtlety regarding how you chose to look or move for the character during the shoot could potentially be changed. Your hair, your clothes, your makeup, etc. Also, your physical placement in the scene can be changed, like your nearness or distance from another character, or even moving you from the front seat of a car to the back seat of a car. This suggests not much agency on your part of your control of your character or performance. And so that's just kind of the tip of the iceberg. We will link you to the whole thing so you can get the whole thing also, because, you know, we only have so much time to talk about all this stuff. But it is a valid concern, and it does open a conversation. And I have been seeing a lot of my fellow actors kind of, you know, jolt up at this notion. And some folks have been mentioning that this may not be the one they want to vote on because of it. So this, while the strike is officially at an end, we may be in some talks for the contract.
And but I think that, yeah, it's a good thing to remember. This is an ongoing, and we are just seeing like the introduction of AI. I think the reason the SAG, not to speak for people I have nothing to do with, but the SAG negotiating committee decided to tap out where they did get to with AI protections is largely based on where the tech is for AI in general, like where those things can be used. And also, you know, this is a 3-year agreement. We are certainly going to be digging into this more, and the technology will have changed an enormous amount in the next 3 years. So I think that them trying to draw the outline of, you know, you can only have this digital double of a role in which you've been cast and a role in which you are paid the number of days that you would have had on set to capture it. So not just like a one-off. So there's a lot of pros and cons that the SAG membership will get into, but it is something, yeah, stick around in 3 years. If we're all still here, you're going to hear us getting into it more the technology changes. And like Marissa said, the law could also change. It's one of those things of, hey man, I'm all for regulations because I know people at their heart are garbage. Regulations can be great. Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah. So we shall see. This is ongoing, but it seems like this is just kind of perusing while we were talking about it. It seems like this is being a, like, something you should know and, you know, make sure you work out in your contract type beats.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So, you know, this is probably going to go forward, and just people will be in the know, and we will protect against it more if we have to.
Okay, then.
Speaking of industry business. Warner Brothers shelved another Finnish movie as a tax write-off, this time The Wile E. Coyote. Last week, we learned that a Finnish film about Warner Brothers icon Wile E. Coyote was the latest to be shelved as a tax write-off by the studio. This time, it was a movie that test audience had already seen and reportedly loved. Then on Monday, news broke that WB will allow director Dave Green to shop Coyote versus Acme to other buyers. The move looks a lot like a reaction to all the bad press garnered by their initial decision. Is this important? Do you care?
Talk about an area where I want to see regulation. It is absolute disgrace to what we do nationwide, but also in this city, being just everyone working in this industry. The idea of looking only at the creations that are coming out of this, if it's TV, if it's film, it's video, it's whatever, as things that could just have hundreds of people working, years and years of time and effort, all of these things, and that there's a tax write-off that is a powerful enough incentive that a studio could be like, you know what, that's going to be better for us. Even something that's an existing, well-known and beloved IP, it stars John Cena, a worldwide star. It tested well. All of these things for it. And you're like, you still think just the write-off of people leave their families for months to work on this stuff.
It was like co-written and produced by James Gunn, who is an exec there. He's like one of the two guys running DC Comics. If his movie can get that, here's what I'm imagining happened. Yes, the press was terrible and it deservedly so, but I bet you, if you are a creative of any kind, then you've got meetings set up with Warner Brothers. You'd be like, no, thank you. Or You have to like start putting a thing in your contract that says, by the way, you're releasing my fucking movie. You're not just going to shelve it. But I mean, Drea, to your point about IP, the other two films they did this to were fucking Batgirl and the Scoob sequel. Like IP is not any kind of protection here. And those films were like I think Scoob was absolutely finished. Batgirl was mostly finished. But yeah, this one was finished, had been tested to audiences, had interest from other streamers, and apparently now another streamer is going to step up, probably Netflix, to put this thing out. But yeah, it is appalling. You know, we talk about these like Silicon Valley type mentality of people, these venture capitalist assholes who come into companies and just see a bunch of assets that they want to then liquidate and make money for the stockholders. And, you know, and we've talked for years about people coming in to run movie studios who don't understand movies or entertainment or have any kind of real love for it. But this is a new low of the kind of gross late stage capitalism bullshit coming from the executive suites. And I hope that nobody works with Warner Brothers Discovery unless they can get them to knock it the fuck off with this stuff, because it's appalling.
Like, was Louis B. Mayer garbage? Sure, certainly. All of them were.
But did he love movies?
Love movies? They did. Like, it is a huge difference. And I understand a bottom line. Like, do I have to reconcile everything for financiers for like justify all artistic? Yes. Like, it's not just, oh, here, you guys might have fun making this thing. We're trying to make something that does well enough to make something else. But you also have to value what you're making, and they do not in any way. And the idea of Apple or Amazon or Netflix or whatever releasing something about Wile E. Coyote in particular is hilarious to me. Come on.
Yeah. You know, it really, and it's wild to, I think, just on a outside of movies macro level to see someone like, you know, just game the tax system like this, and they still don't want to tax billionaires. Like, we're still gonna, you know, run down Meemaw for checking the wrong box and making sure that she's paying back the IRS for the rest of her life. But we see a company openly doing tax write-offs where all the proof's in the pudding that the movie is fine can be put out. And just like, dang, that's crazy. And what they get out of it is more money, because now they have to sell it because of the bad press. You know, like, when are we going to get, you know, the IRS who's going to be like, oh, yeah, no, we should probably check in on these things.
Yeah, no, it's everything's
broken. And I resent you making me cheer for the IRS. I resent that.
Trust me, I'm only cheering for them up until next year, the 18th.
what next? Am I going to be high-fiving the FBI? Come on. All right, speaking of movies, old Darren Aronofsky is developing an Elon Musk biopic at A24. Is it a perfect storm or a biopic Mad Lib? The studio's A24. The director is the man behind Black Swan, Mother, and most recently, The Whale. And the subject is the ex-meister himself, Elon Musk. A24 has optioned the rights to the recent Walter Isaacson biography of Mr. Musk. Isaacson is also the author of the book Steve Jobs, which was adapted into a Danny Boyle film. His biography of Leonardo da Vinci was optioned by Appian Way back in 2017. No movie has come of that yet. Is this important? Do you care? And will this movie be called Elon or Musk?
Apartheid Honky is my suggested title. I can't take credit for that. Somebody on Blue Sky calls him that.
I'm voting for this fucking guy. I feel like they're not going to use that.
Emerald spoon in his mouth. This is a guy who has created nothing and somehow has built up this mystique around himself as being this like visionary inventor. Like, everything that is good about the Tesla came from somebody else, and everything shitty about it pretty much comes from this guy. He was born into wealth that occurred because, you know, apartheid was still happening in South Africa. And he's an anti-trans piece of shit who has turned Twitter into a hotbed for Nazis. So he can fuck right off, and so can this movie.
That is I know words, but it makes sense because it is someone who like likes to make movies about horrible people. So it was only a matter of time.
Oh, and you know, Brendan Fraser is already working on the haircut.
Let me love him. Come on, Brendan. I do like that there's also already controversy about this book of Walter Isaacson's angle in on it, and that, you know, that there were things already sort of questioned about his reporting and that the sourcing was, I'm like, oh, do you really need the intersection of you're looking at Elon Musk anyway, and then you're also bringing in something that's had the reporting kind of questioned of it, like, oh, great. Like, I'm going to believe any of it. Whatever. I get people are making the things they're making, but there's about a kabillion stories I'd rather see than this one. Darren Aronofsky doing this, I'll say the best part of it is up until the whale, I had so tied him with the concept of just making his actresses miserable on screen. So maybe this is a new branch, and maybe he's going to just make men miserable on screen. And
maybe he'll do to this like book what he did with the Bible in Noah, and like, you know, sure, there's rock monsters in Elon Musk's life. Yeah, why not?
Just go crazy. And small note from before, I was totally wrong. Justine Bateman played Alex P. Keaton's sister, not his girlfriend. Ugh.
Yes, Courtney Cox played the girlfriend.
Yes, rude reinvention on my part. My dear.
Yeah, how dare. Oh, well, on that note, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're talking about the Marvels. A Queer History of Aerospace is a new audio miniseries from the Museum of Flight.
Located in Seattle, Washington, the Museum of Flight is the largest private nonprofit air and space museum in the world. A Queer History of Aerospace explores the ways the LGBTQ+ community has shaped aviation and space exploration, and the ways the industry has impacted the LGBTQ+ community. The ultimate goal is to encourage people who have been left off museum walls to share their own histories so that together we can start telling the whole story.
If that sounds awesome to you, you can listen at museumofflight.org/podcast or search The Flight Deck on your favorite podcatcher. New episodes every Tuesday.
All right, let's get back to the show. Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ify Wadiway. In the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Alonzo Duraldi.
Sorry, I was waiting for a third person. Today's film is the sequel to Captain Marvel, but also has ties to several other MCU TV shows and films. It was directed by Nia DaCosta, and it is the 33rd, you heard that right, 33rd film in the MCU, and the third Marvel movie to come out this year. Alonzo, would you mind giving us a brief synopsis of the Marvels?
Sure. So we pick up right where the Disney Plus Ms. Marvel TV series left off, with Carol Danvers suddenly appearing in the closet of Jersey City teenager Kamala Khan, who is Ms. Marvel. It turns out that an evil alien has uncovered a bangle, much like the one that gave Ms. Marvel her powers, and her use of it is... screwing up the light-based powers that are connect Captain Marvel, Carol Danvers, Monica Rambeau, who in the comics is Pulsar, but here doesn't have a cool code name, and Ms. Marvel, and they find themselves abruptly changing places with each other whenever their powers are being used, which leads to quite a bit of confusion because they're in very different parts of the galaxy. Eventually, they are brought together to bring down this common enemy and also deal with their own shit. Monica is annoyed with Ms. Marvel for having left the Earth for several decades. Ms. Marvel is a total Captain Marvel fangirl, but it's still learn the grimmer sides of being a superhero, and it all winds up with a mid-credits Easter egg that everyone is going to be talking about and that radically shifts the future of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. This movie is wacky and goofy. It's the Marvels. The Marvels.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And aren't we accrediting Monica as Professor Marvel? That's how she earned her way into the Marvel. I know that was just like a throw-off, like, joking thing from Kamala, but it stuck. It stuck with me.
Well, it is a Wizard of Oz reference, which every movie is required by law to have. So,
the Professor Marvel?
Yeah, the guy who becomes the Wizard of Oz is Professor Marvel.
Get out of here.
That's his, like, circus name.
Alonzo, I feel like we're not in Kansas anymore.
Yeah, I mean, and when you connect it with the kind of last part of the movie in theme, it makes it even more poetic.
This is true. I hadn't thought about
interesting,
that.
Interesting.
We will get into all of that. But first, let's get into the fact that director Nia DaCosta is on record about how challenging it was to decide how much of the MCU lore needed to be rehashed in order to follow the film's story. How do you feel the movie did with that? Also, I'll make it a double question just to kind of lump them together. Did you watch WandaVision, Ms. Marvel, Secret Invasion, and do you feel like it matters?
I did watch all of that stuff. We've been recapping them on breakfast all day, and I probably would have watched anyway. Secret Invasion doesn't really come into it that much. I mean, the Skrulls, you know, to know their deal. But yeah, if you didn't watch WandaVision or Ms. Marvel, there's some wiki page reading to do, I think, before this movie starts. And that is apparently a beef that a lot of people are having with it, that they've gone so hog wild into tying this stuff together. You heard the same complaints about the Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, where if you didn't watch WandaVision, it didn't really make sense. And also Quantumania, if you weren't watching Loki, who's this Kang guy? So sadly, I think that has become a problem for this movie, which I think is, as we'll get to, I think this movie is sort of suffering from a lot of things that aren't really its fault.
I agree. I think that this film had such a heavier lift than you would imagine for something that has a relatively light tone overall. It's, you know, and I think that if it's, we've definitely passed over into the zone of nightmares for the MCU of when it started. It was this fun exercise of, oh, are there things we can drop or character backgrounds? And then when they come up, it's like the Avengers and there's a nod and it feels really special and whatever. And now it's, oh God, there's so many things at play. And they've shot themselves in the foot with that. And this film in particular, because you're bringing together these three disparate characters that have not been in the same place before. I watched WandaVision. I watched Ms. Marvel because it was Alonzo's staff pick and I listened to Alonzo. He says jump and I say how much Ms. Marvel. And I watched a little Secret Invasion and then petered out. Sorry to this man.
Don't blame you.
No, but I will say I saw it with a friend of mine who hadn't seen those things. And I do think for the most part, she was tracking and there are the nods to it. Here's what you need to know from WandaVision is how Monica got her powers. Like, yeah. Oh, and she's like, I wandered into a
witch's hex.
A witch's hex. And she's like, all right, okay, so you have that. And and the main thing, you're like, oh, Kamala put on this, like, oh, my grandmother traveled through time basically to give me this power bangle. Like, got it. Okay, I'm in. I'm off and running. And then the broader thing with, like, the Skrulls and the Kree, like, I've seen them at different points. The trickier part, even from combining all of those, is we also know all of the characters of all of these worlds are mostly on Earth. So for any of these stories, you're like, well, I need to give this enough conflict and dramatic heft that I'm engaged, that there's a sense of urgency or threat, but also it needs to be specific enough that I'm not like, why don't you just tag in blank, blank. Like,
right.
So it's this whole other of how do we keep this small enough of why it's just these people dealing with it, even though Nick Fury is there and presumably has the other people on speed dial, but also big enough that we're caring, we're worried about the future of different things. And that's where the biggest foot shooting has gone, in my opinion. Well,
it's because we smushed together the, like, natural separation of Marvel levels. I've mentioned this on Marvel episodes before, that typically you have your street level heroes, your global scale heroes, which are the Avengers, and then you have cosmic heroes, which are all to do with the space and the galaxy. And we've seen them cross over and handshake in a way that is like you would assume as a viewer, like they should be involved. And we've also had movies like this in the past where if it did get this big, they did call for backup. You've seen, like, you know, in Thor Ragnarok, and you've seen, I know exactly what you mean, where there was all this crossover and now they're trying to reestablish this fun thing. And it's kind of hard to do that. And then at the same time, towards the end, be like, and we're creating another team. And it's like, but you already have a team. I think there's a neatness that Marvel is trying to do, because you're 33 movies in. You have TV shows. And you don't want to make it seem like, you know, you can't do a bit every movie where someone calls up Spider-Man and he's like, I'm dealing with all this stuff over here. You got to figure it out. But there is like a general accepted thing there. I guess to go back to the first question, I've only seen WandaVision. I haven't seen Ms. Marvel. I haven't seen Secret Invasion. But I think I didn't need to. I got the gist of it. I think the WandaVision one is probably the most important one because of the powers of Monica. Which, yeah, because everyone else's powers and how they got them are pretty straightforward. We see the rehash of how Carol Danvers gets hers. We see the bangle but that was the only thing that got, we'll get to that in a second, but you see the bangle and you assume that's how they have the power. And then you hear like, and I watched Walk Through a Witch Hex, and you're like, wait, hold on, what? I want to know more about that. And I was like, and you can, it's on Disney Plus, $13.99 or however much it costs now. What I really did like about this movie is that it felt like a return to form, where it was just fun. I could feel the movie avoiding like what would be natural tropes for a lot of the reactions to things. I think they could have like drawn out the Carol Danvers, Monica anger. Instead, they've kind of had them face it head on. They could have drawn out that like these folks can never get it together because Carol doesn't want to be on a team. And they're like, nope. Carol is like, yep, I'm going to try and be on board. And then they gave all of the queers what they wanted by having Tessa Thompson show up in a suit. Yes. And have just a little bit of romantic tension between Carol, and you're like, what's going on here? And then get out of there.
Was Carol wearing her amazing like lesbian squadron tank top in that moment? That tank top changed a lot of lives, I think. I loved when Tessa showed up because Nia's first film, Little Woods, which premiered at Tribeca and released, starred Tessa Thompson and was like a very small indie, and having them both end up in this Marvel universe is kind of miraculous. I would even make the case that as much as and there's been a lot written about Nia's being up front of, oh, I know I'm working here to the service of what Kevin Feige wants. Like, it's not an independent film. It is not, this is my artistic creation. But you are trying as a director in these, where they are really sort of hired guns there to implement someone else's vision. But you are also trying to put your own sort of veneer on it. And I do think there's something of the shaping of this story. Even what Iffy was just specifying, I found that very feminine. I found it very, oh, we're going to talk through this right away. We're not going to be like shooting each other glances or, oh, this is the elephant in the room. Like, no, it's a...
We're going to process.
Yes, we're going to get to it. You are upset with me and I hear you on that. I deserve your... Like, I was like, yes.
I make space for you.
Yes, these women in their, like, spandex being like, let's just talk to the emotional heart of
this.
I
make space for you in space.
I love it so... Yeah, yeah.
Across space. Here's the thing with me in this movie. I think I was entertained and delighted quite frequently. Not all the time, but for much of it, and enough of it that I came out thinking, like, that was something really lovely and fun. But then the more that I think about it, what makes me crazy about this, and again, it's Kevin Feige being the real auteur here, is that this movie is dying to go out in weird and wonderful directions. And it starts in those directions at several times, and then you can just feel the forces of Disney, Marvel, back in the square hole, you know? And so it's like you get this crazy planet where everyone communicates by singing and dancing, and you're like, oh yeah, let's do it. Especially because you've got Kamala Khan, who is knows from Bollywood movies, obviously, and they could really have like turned that into something. And you just it's like in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, where like that musical number keeps almost starting, but they don't let it, you know, it's like, stop singing, you know, it doesn't get to go full tilt nutty in the way that I'm sure, like, it seemed like DaCosta really wanted to go. And then you get that brilliant scene with the Flurkin and reclaiming memory from Cats after that movie, which also is like deliciously bananas. And again, it's like, if we could just allow Marvel movies to be different kinds of films within this superhero world, make a musical, make a workplace comedy, like do, you know, let them breathe on their own and have their own pace rather than have to abide lockstep into this formula. And I just felt the formula nipping everything fun about this movie in the bud.
I found it very fun overall as well. I mean, like, for me, enjoyable view. But I totally agree, driving home with my friend, of talking about especially that musical sequence. And I'm like, man, they really could have let that rip. Like, beautiful costumes, beautiful thing. They set it up. And there wasn't a good payoff, either humor or set piece, of diving into, like, yes, give me something very stupidly entrenched musical, if it's classic Hollywood, if it's Bollywood, if it's whatever, or that it ends on like a big joke or something. And instead, it's this kind of like, oh, you're sort of singing some things and then not singing some others. I agree. I think that could have gone further. That was the biggest puff there for me. But part of the fun was the idea of what the catalyst for all of this, the idea if you know any nerds, you've definitely discussed the concept of quantum entanglement before, because it's real and fascinating, and please look it up. How it's utilized here is this kind of weird marvelizing of their superpowers, and these three women have their skill sets, which all sort of involve the same kind of energy, light, power, whatever. And so whenever they utilize it, they switch places. And I like that, because it's not a body swap thing. It's just, oh, I've like
a location swap.
A location swap. And that is so fun for fight scenes. Mm-hmm. For they keep doing these things where there's like a lot of fight scenes in domestic places, like the Khan's home in Queens, and like, and people are just showing up there with aliens and whatnot, and then they're like on a spaceship with Nick Fury and you're bouncing back, and then them figuring out how to harness that. I felt like that was such a nice, great, what a nice, neat, boop, boop. And then even that was sort of murky, because there were times you're like, just don't use your powers, because that's when we switch. And I'm like, well, she's flying right now.
Yeah. Does that count?
Is flight, is that not a thing? She's still hurt. Like, so there was a little of that that I'm like, I feel like that could be dumbed down a little more. I mean, I get it, but.
Thank you for correcting me, by the way. It is Queens. I don't know why I keep thinking she lives in Jersey City, but yes, Queens, Queens, Queens.
Yeah. Well, her big action moment was Jersey, right? Like.
Maybe. Yeah. I forgot.
I can't remember. But yeah, I very much liked that as the impetus to bringing them together, how this is going, and what that meant for integrating our villain. And I would definitely love to discuss that. The idea that Tom Hiddleston's fiance played the villain in this, funny to me forever. Like, bring in Loki's wife, and then just straight up she dies at the end. Like, the most inconsequential villain in the scope of things is kind of hilarious. But what did you guys think of Darben? Darben?
Yeah. Kind of generic as a villain, I think. I mean, I'll say this. I don't think the Kree-Skrull war has been presented particularly interestingly in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It was a huge thing in the comics back in like the 70s when they unleashed it. And the films and TV shows have kind of turned it around by making the Skrulls kind of the good guys for the most part, if there's mm-hmm. going to be good mm-hmm. guys in all this. But it's between Secret Invasion and this, it's like, you're not making a case why we should care about this.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, right, is the Kree
Skrull War. It almost feels like it's had its time and we're ready to move past it. But it felt also like this, like, it felt like this was just a tool to kind of like finish out the arc for Carol, where it's like, okay, you acted out of anger, so now you get, you need to know that you can't just be trying to save everyone and just, and you can't be as callous. It's all about like the effect you leave on people and that you are more than that. And in the way of it, because like I got the energy they were having where it's like, this person is a villain, kind of. This person is like, this person is an effect of Carol's action. So they're not all the way bad, but they kind of are because they die at the end. and I think it is one of those things that y'all were talking about where it's like in a movie on its own, I'm sure this would have been a very like dope, complex story about like how your actions, even heroic actions, can lead to creating new villains. But because they had to add in the split and the break in the worlds that will eventually allow this new parallel universe to be a part of it, to try and connect, you know, the Nick Fury and the Skrull of it all, and to put, making sure the Skrulls get to Valhalla because they don't have a home. Like, there's just so many.
And this is also like the shortest MCU movie, too, right? Yeah. Like, it's 105 minutes.
It creates
which I thank Nia for that.
Yeah,
but I'm just saying that's a oh. But I think they didn't have the real estate to expand on these ideas because it is, and I, normally I'm for these movies being shorter, but this is a case where it's like you had enough new elements here where, you know, if you'd gone a little over two, you could have spent it doing something.
I see what you mean.
Just
yeah.
vamping, you know.
That time was there. I'll say just the last thing based on Iffy. One element of this that I did think was a misstep in. Completely because of the time that we live in, this, in terms of not giving enough time or thought or nuance or something, the idea that this was centering around people who were being denied a homeland and being repressed by another people, I was like, oh man, you are all,
oh, yeah.
Sorry, MCU, I don't see you solving this nor handling it in a sophisticated manner. And that was something that I found. Yeah. So, I was so acutely aware of the whole time. I'm like, oh, there are very easy metaphors to be drawn here. And you are neither offering a solution or even like it just was not as nuanced. Just don't take that on. Maybe don't take that on.
Yeah, that's, I had that in the back of my head too, where it's like the timing of it all just could not have been poorer.
What if we didn't?
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe, yes. Maybe you're not trying to have two people battling over the same land. Yeah.
Yeah.
Vote.
Yes. So it's time for us to vote. We all know how to do it. But if this is your first time listening, the way we vote for things on this pod is screen it being the highest, stream it being the next level, and skip it being self-explanatory. So who wants to start?
I will say stream it. I think that there is, like I said, I was entertained. I was even occasionally delighted by this movie, but at the same time, it did feel like it was hedging its bets on its sort of coolest, weirdest aspects. But I love this cast. I've really enjoyed all three of these characters. And I think that especially, Iman Vellani, who plays Kamala Khan, is a real find. And, I hope that this opens other doors for her. But yeah, I'd say in the grand scheme of things, you know, if you were to watch this on Disney Plus, it wouldn't be the end of the world. But you know, if you've seen the rest of them in theaters, then fuck it, see this one too, why not?
Well, with that, I must screen it. Largely, I had just a very fun time. This was a very, I felt 15 watching this, and not just because I had a crush on Kamala's brother, who's such a babe. But also see this because you need to see them flirting cats big. I was thrilled by every cat that showed up. And let me tell you, it's a lot more cats than you're expecting. Also, I'm hoping that the fact that there are rampant Flurgans all over New York now better also factor into future Marvels if they're tying things. But yeah, I found it really fun. Like, certainly some of it didn't go far enough, but it was lighthearted and enjoyable, and it wasn't trying to do all of the dumb things that the other one, that many of them contend to do. And I also would very much like for Kamala's hero worship of Carol Danvers to somehow factor into a future coming out story for her, because that is how I choose to read it.
Yeah, it's going to be a screen for me, for multiple reasons. One, Nia DaCosta, I think, knocked it out the park and feels closer to where we came from as far as like Marvel movies. It kind of leaned in on the fun. It leaned in on the excitement of like being a hero. And I think the story was great. I will say I am chasing the carrot on a stick that is the spoiler. You can skip 30 seconds ahead if you don't want to hear it. X-Men in the after credits. We've waited so long for them all to meet, and they gave us the beast that we have always asked for. And I'm back in. I'm back in until they let me down again.
To be clear, but, yeah, I'm not disappointed in Nia DaCosta. I'm disappointed in Kevin.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think y'all did a great job of like pointing that out. And I think you're making such a good point of like how the balancing act of carrying a ongoing continuity and trying to tell this like overarching story in this new phase kind of hurts the creativity that we see from these directors who are like taking on these movies.
No question. You know, we'll never know what the Edgar Wright Ant-Man would have been like.
But we'll know what this hotline call's all about. So we'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
Have you ever wanted to know the sad lore behind Chuck E. Cheese's love of birthday parties?
Or, my Saturday mornings were reserved for cartoons?
Or, have you wanted to know how beloved virtual pet site Neopets fell into the hands of Scientologists?
Or, how a former Mattel employee managed to grow Sega into a video game powerhouse?
Join us, hosts Austin and Brenda, and learn all of these things and more at Secret Histories of Nerd Mysteries, now on Maximum Fun.
I'm Yucky Jessica.
I'm Chut Crudsworth.
And this is Terrible,
a podcast where we talk about things we hate that are awful.
Today we're discussing Wonderful, a podcast on the Maximum Fun Network.
Hosts Rachel and Griffin McElroy, a real-life married couple.
Yuck!
Discuss a wide range of topics. Music, video games, poetry, snacks.
But I hate all that stuff.
I know you do, Yucky Jessica.
It comes out every Wednesday, the worst day of the week, wherever you download your podcasts.
For our next topic, we're talking Fiona, the baby hippo from the Cincinnati Zoo.
I hate this little hippo.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ify Whiteyway. In the studio with me are
Alonzo Duraldi,
Drea Clark.
And today we've got a hotline letter from a longtime listener, Mark, who writes, "What film character lives in your heart as someone who didn't live to the end of the credits and you still aren't over it? I think seeing Independence Day when I was in high school and being thrilled that there was an openly gay character, which felt like a forbidden rarity, Harvey Fierstein's Marty Gilbert, unfortunately gets zapped with most the rest of the population of New York by a space laser, and I'm still sore about it. Curious to hear who occupies an eternal RIP, rest in peace, in your brains. So, first off, spoiler alert for the next 5 to 10 minutes, but..." I'll let someone start, but I think I have a pretty good one for mine.
Can I? Okay, I have one, but I'm worried it might be Iffy's because I know it is from his favorite movie. So I'm going to say this in honor of him.
Which one?
Donnie.
No.
From The Big Lebowski.
No, but that's good.
You're
that's,
out of your good. Element, Donnie.
Yes.
You're like a child who's wandered into the middle of a movie. Steve Buscemi's character.
Yes.
And his death also gives us an incredible scene where Walter tosses his ashes into the face of the... So, like, It pays off. But I love Donnie. Like, I love everything that Steve Buscemi does anyway. But Donnie in that world of being such a, like, sweet but grumbly idiot. Oh, I could have watched more of that. Had him show up all the time. Have him wander in like a child who wanders into the middle of a movie in every scenario.
Well, in our house for a long time, the answer to this would have been Giselle from Fast and the Furious, but she's apparently not dead now.
That would have been a great one.
So I guess we can let that go now, finally. Mine is not really a spoiler, but it is, you know, Christmas adjacent because I can't help myself. That would be Beth March from any version of Little Women. Aww. Particularly Claire Danes, but, you know, Eliza Scanlon, you know, there's a Margaret O'Brien. You give me a sad, soulful Beth and getting the piano and then, you know, gracefully expiring. It's always just gets me right there. So as far as I'm concerned, she and Marmee and the gang are still just fine.
Marmee.
Yes. So mine, because there's like a specific flavor I feel like this question has, which is like kind of like just a little peeved at the death, you know, a little like
how dare you?
I was hyped, yeah, how dare you? And so with that one, I'm always gonna have to give it to Darwin, who was in X-Men First Class. Yeah. Who his whole power was that he would be able to overcome anything. He would be able to evolve to not die, and somehow still died. Like it was like a
you had one job.
Yeah, it was like an extra. It was like almost to a tease to be like, oh, you thought this black guy wasn't gonna die in this movie? Guess what? Is his power? He can't die, not through the power of cinema. So yeah, I guess thanks Matthew Vaughn for like because it's so funny because it is often Black Twitter will bring this death up over and over again, and I'm sure on paper when you were writing this movie, it was like, oh, this will just show like the power of this character because this character is so powerful that it can't die. So then when he kills Darwin, it just shows how powerful it is. But you forgot that it was the one black guy in your movie. And so when that happens, it looks like you went out of your way.
It does seem very intentional.
Yeah. It reminds me of the movie that came out earlier this year that I know it was at least a staff pick, the Blackening, where the tagline was, we can't all die first.
Yes, exactly.
We can't all, that was it. Oh, the Blackening. Can I also add, and this is one that's sort of, this happened in the movie version, but it's a TV character in many ways. But in Serenity, which is the obviously film version of the world from Firefly, Alan Tudyk's character Wash dies. And it's similar to Donnie in that it's like, oh, it's a sacrifice for kind of emotionally manipulative reasons that now we get to see like, oh, they were so close to making it. But now, oh, no, she's lost her partner and they've lost the like lighthearted member of their crew. And that one, I'm like, boo. Boo Earns, bring back the genuinely funny member of this team. Never kill off Alan Tudyk.
Unless he's a villain in a Pixar movie.
Yeah.
Yes, that's fair. Okay, wait, I do have another one. Now I'm on it. In the Bourne world, the Bourne Identity, all of that, in the second one, and I can't remember which of them, killing off Franka Potente annoys me. I feel like that character was alive in the books. His partner that he disappears with at the end, and they're like, oh, let's go to some island and like own a bike rental company or some nonsense. And then she gets killed. And I'm like, can't we just think that she's off living her best life, like in her multilingual world? Why can't she just be bummed about Jason? Why has she got to be dead? Okay. I don't like these when it's completely motivated to like, this character is not going to have any, reason to do anything unless we kill someone close to them.
Yeah. Yep. You know, it seems like a classic, you know.
That's trope. That's fridging in the comics, right?
Yes. Like, oh, yeah. Yeah. So let's stop it.
Please.
But no, thank you so much to Mark, yes, who gave us that fun question. It was great answering
solid
it.
Question.
Always, anytime I can bring up the Darwin event, which is what I call it now.
And I think, and Roland Emmerich kills a gay in the second Independence Day movie, too, now that I think about it.
Okay, we got to put them on notice.
And he made Stonewall. Like, this is really knocking
off. I was like, isn't Roland Emmerich gay?
Yes.
That's his whole thing. He's a movie maker who's gay. German.
He wants us to feel included, I guess. I don't know.
I guess.
Well, look, remember you can leave a voice message for the hotline by going to MaximumFun.org/hotline or email MaximumFilm@MaximumFun.org. And now, Alonzo, your time has arrived. You're going to summarize the holiday movies you watched this week in under a minute. Thanksgiving is just around the corner, so maybe this is starting to get a little bit of a challenge.
Yeah, it's a longer list this week, so here
we go. You got it, kid.
All right, well, are you ready?
Yes.
All right.
Okay, we're Scrooged and Christmas Time Capsule, both on Up TV. Better than the usual Up TV movie, which is not necessarily saying a ton, but it's a start. Mystery on Mistletoe Lane, a nice attempt by Hallmark to do a mystery that's a Christmas movie, but doesn't really go anywhere very interesting. Neither does Everything Christmas, which depicts people who love Christmas as idiots, and I didn't like that. And Christmas Island, which is a testament to the star power of Andrew Walker, because he's the only thing that makes this thing work at all. A Heidelberg Holiday, however, one of the best Hallmark movies I've ever seen. Great location shooting. Not as good as Santa Summit, but still terrific, and like there are a couple that make this feel like the season's on a roll. Klaus Family 2, Netflix Dutch sequel, darker than an American movie would ever be, but still kind of cool, and has some fun with the whole Santa mythos and a troubled teen story. And then It's a Wonderful Life is an ambitious horror comedy that is trying to play on It's a Wonderful Life while also being a slasher. I'm not 100% on board with it, but I like this movie's moxie and it has some fun ideas, and Justin Long makes a really interesting villain worth checking out.
The follow-up question, does Justin Long's villain in that have a tape measure?
No, but it
like
he is
Barbarian.
But he is a real estate mogul, so there is a through line.
Okay, so okay. Yeah, they're
I'll accept that.
All right, well, speaking of accepting things, time for us to accept our staff picks. It could be any movie at all. Who wants to start?
I have one. It is a film being released in theaters today, I believe, the day that this comes out. May, December. Todd Haynes' new film. And I somehow completely missed what the narrative origin of this was. It stars Natalie Portman, Julianne Moore, and Charles Melton in a story inspired by Mary Kay Letourneau and her 13-year-old baby daddy, Billy Fulau. And anyone who lived in America at that time remembers her getting impregnated by her almost prepubescent former student, and them getting married and having children and being still together. And this is a world where Julianne Moore had worked at a pet store with a very, very young man. And then she went to prison for their very inappropriate relationship, and they're married now decades later, and Natalie Portman is going to play her in a movie. And if all that doesn't sound like deliciously interesting, and then you know it's made by Todd Haynes, and so it's given a layer of artistry.
It's Todd Haynes' like, That's My Boy.
Complexity, yeah. Anyway, May, December, Netflix. I think it's in theaters first and then coming out in Netflix.
Theaters first, yeah. Then coming to Netflix, yes. And I'm very excited to see this because Todd Haynes, one of my favorite living filmmakers. Because unlike Drea, I am here to support women filmmakers.
Burn!
No, but to tie in with the Marvels, another great film directed by women about women is the documentary The Disappearance of Cher Height that opens this weekend. From IFC. It is about the famed 1970s sexologist Cher Height. I remember the Height Report being a very big deal when I was a kid and too young to read it, but you know, it was in magazines. She was on talk shows. It was a very big deal. And then she kind of went away and left the public consciousness, and I never knew why. And now I've seen this documentary, and I totally know why. The title suggested some kind of true crime story, but no, it's not that. It's about how the media often conspires to silence women, particularly when they tell damning truths about men's emotional inner lives. I found this movie riveting. It is a cool visit to the 1960s and 70s. When this amazing woman who was like a glamorous model, but also a sex researcher, you know, kind of like enters the zeitgeist and the forces that conspire to drive her out of that zeitgeist. Highly recommend. Really enjoyed it. One of the best documentaries I saw this year. The Disappearance of Cher Height.
I will back this up. It's a solid watch. It premiered at the Sundance Film Festival.
Oh, you don't say.
I do say. And it's a. It's directed by Nicole Newman, who co-directed Crip Camp, yes. which we talked about here.
Yes.
But I had never heard of Cher Height before. So if you're like me and this was a brand new, it added even more layers to my cultural awareness.
Mm-hmm. And mine's is going to be nice and simple of a layup. If you like Nia DaCosta and Tiana Paris, who crushed yes. in this film, then you know I'm going to talk about Candyman, specifically in spite of the yes. dumbass nerds who said, this director only directed one movie and didn't do it anyway. Candyman crushed box office, first off and
also,
foremost.
Also, that was her second movie.
Yes.
This but, you is know, her third.
But don't worry, the Marvel nerds who are looking it up, they're not looking, you know, they're not
nobody's looking
at that.
Anything
and they're
up,
not even
yeah.
looking at the men whose previous movies we've seen, and don't let me get into Sons of Directors because then we'll get real spicy.
Yeah, no.
But I will take this moment for positivity and say yes. how dope Candyman was,
yes.
and definitely check it out. And it's them working together. Speaking of like collaborations coming back together on Marvel projects, yeah, that was one that we didn't mention. So give that a watch.
If you just said it three times,
just no, so you no. know. Dre and Alonzo, thank you for another wonderful show. It truly is a dream getting to sit down with y'all and talk about these movies. You know, even going into like, you know, the stuff that I would normally watch like this to stuff I probably might have slept on, you know, like things like Killers of the Flower Moon or such hits as Judy, you know, so, you know, I just want to appreciate you. We're getting close to Thanksgiving and I just got to talk about how thankful I am to sit down with you.
Gratitude. Likewise, baby.
And you, the listener, whose ears we're in every Friday. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, send us an email at MaximumFilm@MaximumFun.org or find us on any of our social media channels, which links are in the show notes. Next week, we're going to be talking about Rustin, but our producer is the wonderful Marissa Flaxbart. Our senior producer is the wonderful Laura Swisher. And this is a wonderful production of Maximum Fun. Bye-bye.
Maximum Fun.
A worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows.
Supported directly
by you.